Today on Life and Faith.
Boil down all the books on development in all the libraries in the world, and there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of volumes. They really come down to what works. It's relationship. That your culture matters, that you have respect from us, that we will not take control of your life, but ask you what control and changes you want to make in your life. That takes time and relationship. That's actually the key to development.
Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. This week we're continuing our interview with Tim Costello. Tim, who is now working part-time for CPX, is well known in Australia as an activist on behalf of the vulnerable and as one of our most respected public Christians. He's sometimes referred to as Australia's pastor. He's recently released a memoir, A Lot with a Little. And we started talking about this in last week's episode. If you missed that, I recommend you catch up. There's lots of interesting stories there. A defining role for Tim was as CEO of World Vision Australia, where he was confronted with some of the most traumatic experiences and trouble spots in the world, and the devastation caused by natural and human-induced disasters. We'll talk to him about that today, including the challenge these experiences presented to his faith and how he processed so much human suffering. But first up, a revealing exchange Tim had with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
It was quite a moment. So I was, when Australia had the presidency of the G20, I was the leader of the C20, Civil Society 20. So G20 has business outreach groups, labour outreach groups, civil society. And so there we are in Moscow for the prep meeting before the St. Petersburg G20 that I attended. And Putin is wanting to show that he's a great Democrat who supports civil society. So we have a fully televised meeting with him that goes for an hour in Putin's dasha. I asked the innocent question as we're arriving in this mansion 2 hours out of Moscow, is this Putin's private property or the government's? No one could answer it.
Because it's not, as you sometimes imagine, the little, you know, wooden hut by the lake.
No. Think medieval castle with kilometres of forest for Putin's riding and swimming, absolutely. And the meeting is going okay. I was amazed that the television was running and all the press were there for the whole meeting. As we know, you have a meeting, then you agree on what you're going to report afterwards. Putin's so confident. The press is so under the thumb that he had them in from the start. Tackled him on Syria, tackled him on a range of issues. The most interesting one, because he raised it, was he said, you're a reverend. He said, I'm telling young Russians to go back to the church. They need something. Now, maybe he really believed that. I do know it's convenient because the Orthodox Patriarch receives millions of rubles from Putin and the government to build churches and then says in exchange, Putin is God's man for Russia. They're very close. So as the question of a reverend came up, I took my chance and said, Pussy Riot, I know when they sang in St. Saviour's in Moscow, were sacrilegious and deeply offended the church, but why punish them by sending them to Siberia? Effectively concentration camps. Surely the church that believes in the gospel of forgiveness would say we're offended, but we forgive. This look of utter incomprehensibility came over Putin's face, and he turned to me and he said, why would a church ever say that? And I realized, sadly, the church had become a department of state. But it was one of those moments.
Now, you travelled a lot in your role at World Vision, often to the most desperate places of human need. Tell us about that baptism of fire in your first big trip, I think it was to Sudan.
Yeah, so Bashir is now under arrest and being tried in Sudan, but he ruled for 30 years and unleashed unbelievable cruelty in Darfur, a region the size of France, 300,000 dead, massive camps of people starving to death that I, World Vision, responded to. And it was a baptism of fire because through interpreters talking to black women, Dinka Noor, South Sudanese people from Kordofan, other regions, there wasn't one who either hadn't been raped or a daughter hadn't been raped. And I suddenly realised that on top of death and destruction of villages was systematic rape. The power of men, Janjaweed as they were called, that President Bashir had unleashed, Arab militias and armed. I came back to Australia. I was talking about this experience at a crowded press conference. It was run on national TV, and I literally just cried through a press conference. It was that looking at the face of evil in the eye. Why are humans so malevolent, so evil? And that's the great mystery, because so much of our experience is that there's such goodness in people and generosity. But when you see evil and look it in the eye, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, I'm interested in this because I think your experiences in this role certainly confronted you with the nature of human beings, both the good and the bad. I wonder what your faith had to say to that. Well, how did that inform and match up with what you then experienced?
Well, this is where Mum and Dad merge for me. Mum starting with creation, and it's good, and God wants us to flourish, and that's the purpose. Dad starting with fall and saying there is evil that runs through every human heart. There's not just black hats and white hearts. We're all capable of it. Both I hold as true. Reinhold Niebuhr, who I refer to in the book, Barack Obama's favourite theologian, said the only Christian doctrine with empirical evidence is the doctrine of original sin, namely that we are evil, that we can do cruel things because we see it everywhere.
And do you think of this as every... You do think that, right? That all people are capable of great good but also great evil.
I do believe that. I see it in myself. I know, there's a Saint Tim Costello out there with the projected persona that I may have fooled some with, but there are nasties within me. The desire to seek revenge, to be resentful, to be envious, and I know that that evil is potentially within me.
Now, you saw not only human evil, but terrible natural, what we call natural disasters. And I know years ago we talked about your experience in the Asian tsunami. I wonder if you can give us just a brief account of kind of the most lasting legacy of that for you, the memory of it, because it was a very confronting moment for you, wasn't it?
It was. The two lasting things for me, I was never... ever again after that, a sunny optimist. I'd always thought, I can make a difference. We'll just get engaged. When 300,000 people died in that tsunami in seven countries where I saw mass graves, mainly women and children, because they could not run or hold onto a tree like men, they weren't as strong or fast. Bodies of kids, unclaimed, unknown in death, thrown into mass graves to stop the spread of cholera. Something within me around optimism just changed. This was just too big. That sense that life is arbitrary and it is fragile. But the second thing goes to my faith. In the luxury of Australia, we ask the question, well, where's God and why didn't he stop it? And it's a fair enough question, but it comes from our self-sufficiency and protection. What I saw first in Sri Lanka and then in Bandar Aceh at the height of the aftermath of the tsunami was faith was the only resource people had. They could not face getting out of bed to rebuild, having lost loved ones and lost their property, without a sense of faith, that there is purpose to my life still, that God, Allah, however they name, that still is overlooking me and wanting me to do this.
There's a great resource for people in the face of terrible desolation.
And it's become true for me, Simon. I have no intellectual answers to some of the reasons for natural evil, other than in faith, God's presence has come into this world and suffered the worst, betrayal and crucifixion, and still goes on loving.
Now, you have had some connection too with Rwanda, and Rwanda has a very, you know, captures both of these things that we're talking about, the most awful human cruelty and barbarity. But there's a really interesting bright side to this story, isn't there? And the concept of forgiveness, almost impossible, I think, to imagine in that context. Tell us about the difference that has made to the subsequent, you know, period of Rwandan history.
This blew me away. I went, you know, to the 10th anniversary, the 15th, the 20th anniversary in Rwanda. So I've actually had a longitudinal look at this. The overwhelming nature of the number of perpetrators meant you couldn't have normal courts. They had what they called the gachacha courts, literally means grass courts, which were, if as a perpetrator you confess and you showed loved ones where that body is, then there will be a big discount on your sentence. And I was quite amazed that a number of perpetrators weren't ready to confess, understandably. But families of victims, out of their Christian faith, before perpetrators had confessed, said, we forgive you. We forgive you. Now, in my theology, you've got to repent and then you earn forgiveness. And these perpetrators hadn't repented. So why should they be forgiven? And what I saw was that perpetrators were so surprised that family, victims, communities forgave them. It led them to confessing and to showing what they'd done and where the bodies were. It opened up this space that said, actually, forgiveness precedes something. And in terms of being a Christian nation, I said to Rwandans, how can you forgive? And they put it very simply, because God forgave us. While we're still sinners, Christ died for us. I was quoting a verse. This sense that turned my theology on its head. Tutu put it best. He said, no future without forgiveness. And I've seen that in Rwanda.
Now, you've worked a lot in these situations and trying to bring relief, and sometimes there's a sort of the immediate relief that comes with that, but you were also very involved with the long-term goals, the Millennium Development Goals, trying to fight against the most extreme poverty. And you said that in your book that this is the greatest example of global cooperation that you've seen. It did achieve some really good things, didn't it?
Amazing things. We forget that in 1997, 42% of Indians and Chinese were living in absolute poverty. That's $2 a day or less. Today, it's 12% of Indians, down from 42% living in poverty. In China, it's under 1% living in poverty. Now, it's not just China and India. Poor nations, landlocked with sometimes nasty neighbours with no resources because of aid and the Millennium Development Goals, have seen that same amazing uplift from people living in poverty, from half your kids dying. And people say, yeah, but what about population crisis? The best way to stop the population boom of having lots of kids is when you see your kids aren't dying. Then you stop having as many kids and you say, we just want two or three and we want them educated. The way to beat the population crisis is actually lifting people out of poverty. So the Millennium Development Goals were the greatest international example, and yet it's tragic to me that the world doesn't know the story, particularly as we turn inwards with the drums of nationalism beating. We're rearming to the teeth. We're saying we'll make our country great and stuff the rest. The Millennium Development Goals halved over half the number of kids dying of dumb poverty. It's dumb because we know how to do clean water. It's dumb because we've got enough food. It's dumb because we can treat preventable diseases. And that lifting of people out of maternal deaths and infant deaths happened in 15 short years because the world, 193 countries, got together and got focused.
Now, in both your inner city work, but also in your more global efforts to kind of combat poverty and so on, you're very big on the idea of relationship being the key. That in both contexts, you've felt that to be the case. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, people think development work or even work in a city with drug addicts or people who have criminal backgrounds as sort of, a program and input. It's actually the relational dimension of having enough respect for where they're at so you can, out of relationship, speak into their lives, your drinking, your domestic violence, and because you've developed relationship, you can speak. It's exactly the same in Indigenous work, by the way. The rotating door of not-for-profits and for-profits going in to help and not, never staying, multiple relationships that are superficial mean that it's very hard for Indigenous ever to trust. Boil down all the books on development in all the libraries in the world, and there's, hundreds of thousands of volumes. They really come down to what works. It's relationship, that your culture matters, that you have respect from us, that we will not take control of your life, but ask you what control and changes you want to make in your life. That takes time and relationship. That's actually the key to development.
Today on Life and Faith, we're listening to our interview with Tim Costello, talking about his memoir, A Lot with a Little. Tim's role as CEO of World Vision Australia forced him to deal with the complicated issue of human suffering and what can be done about it. And as his memoir shows, his Christian vision of the world and our place in it was a hugely motivating thing for him in the battle to combat poverty. So I wanted to ask Tim, what is that vision? And why was it so effective in getting him out of bed every day to do his work?
Yeah, it is this knowledge that I offer worship to something far bigger than just creation, far bigger than just the things that we do worship in our culture, sex, power, money, self-image, flag, nation, that all sort of deal with anxieties superficially, but they're just created things. They're not the creator. I add to that social justice and environmentalism. I'm passionately committed to both, but they're not God. If I simply worship them and felt I wasn't making enough progress, I would burn out. Faith is why it lifts me beyond that to say, in my faith, this is God's world. God loves it. God hasn't given up on it, even in its brokenness and its madness and its malevolence. And I'm not the Messiah. I'm called to do my bit, but this is over to God. And spiritually and psychologically, that's profoundly important. And it's what I mean by the act of worship, handing over, surrendering.
Tim, the question of how to handle the demands of those seeking asylum in our country is very complex and controversial. I don't need to say that. It's a morally serious challenge, isn't it, for our country? What is it about a system that is astonishingly effective in stopping people coming to Australia by boat and yet is so dehumanising? I know you're not a fan. It's difficult though, right?
Oh, look, Australia can't take the 24 million refugees. 65 million people are displaced. Most want to go back home as soon as war has finished. They don't want to. But refugees, about 24 million, can't go back because of religious or political persecution. Now, we had far more refugees after the Second World War and we're much poorer and we placed them. In my view, if richer countries took their fair share, we can place these people. Australia's fair share, we've worked out, is about 42,000 per year in our humanitarian intake.
How do you get to that figure?
So you take wealth and population and you divide it by the number of refugees, some 23, 24 million, over a period of 5-10 years. And Australia's share on wealth and population is 42,000. These are international figures. We're taking about 18,000. And one of them was a one-off job lot, 12,000 Syrian refugees. So we can't solve this when countries are going, not my problem. We can solve this in Australia because we take 280,000 immigrants a year, often cherry-picking the brightest and best from African and poor countries to be our doctors or whatever skills we need, leaving those countries who've paid for the education depleted. Now, I don't want to personally stop people who want to leave having that chance, but when people say, oh no, we couldn't take 42,000 humanitarian refugees, you look often at the skills of these people. They are remarkably skilled and hungry for a chance because they did nothing wrong other than conflict.
Yeah, other than be born somewhere where there's conflict.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So I've never advocated open borders. Hmm. I've just advocated our
fair really share. Advocating for the share. I think it's one question people will have too, and I've heard people who are refugee advocates say this: you do have to have an adequate infrastructure for when they arrive too, and that's at least a factor in this equation, I imagine.
Yeah, but we're taking 250,000 people. It keeps us out of recession, by the way. Technically, we would be in but for immigration. I don't mind decreasing that figure down, that if it includes the 42,000, that's our fair share. I'm saying it's no extra on infrastructure because that's what we're taking anyway. And cut it back even further if infrastructure needs aren't being met because state governments are struggling, but at least fulfill our humanitarian quota. So for me, what I think I say in the book, what damaged the Australian soul, roll up your sleeves, sunny optimist, generous people, I think was 15 years of paralysing, toxic debate about boat people, saying we fear them. I've been quoting Gandhi quite a lot. Gandhi said, we think the enemy's hate. It's not. The real enemy is fear. Now, fear says, oh, we can't do this. Well, we can. And we've done it before, post-Second World War. Fear says, oh, somehow, even though they're refugees, they may be a threat. Well, that's why you do the assessments. That's why you check. So it's not open slather. So that fear, I think, has damaged the Australian soul.
One of the things that I feel is like it's almost a subtext in your book is there are moments where you hint at the fact that you've worked very hard and maybe sometimes there are periods where you overdid that. Is that a fair guess?
That's fair. No, that's very fair. You know, when you're leading World Vision, whose modest goal is to end world poverty, there's a little bit of an overreach that goes on. And there have been moments where I think I lost perspective. And it's why certainly not just faith, but friends who grounded me, who could tell me when I'm having a lend of myself.
Because there's family implications for this.
Yeah, and I have permission in the book to talk about my kids. Each of them signed off on it. One of the most revealing moments, and my daughter's very brave to allow this to be told in the book, is that she has struggled since 17 with a mental illness. And that was very tough on her, being the oldest grandchild with the burden of the Costello surname, and knowing that... as she would put it to me, I didn't do drugs, I wasn't promiscuous, why did this happen to me? And it's the ancient question, why do bad things happen to good people? And there have been times when I've lived with the doubt, I'm off saving the world, I can't save my own daughter. My wife, who is the really remarkable person, and she's had a very close job in reading and editing some of this, is really The Rock, who has held that together when I've overreached, lost perspective.
All through the book, you talk about the influence of Jesus on your life. Well, what difference does this ancient person make to life today?
Well, there's certainly the most novel ethic that the world has ever seen, love your enemies. I've often said avoid your enemies would have been useful. Love your enemies. He actually believed that even your enemy has something sacred in them, and therefore violence towards your enemy is not permissible. It's why I named my youngest son Martin after Martin Luther King. When Martin Luther King, a Baptist minister, his churches are being bombed, dogs set on them, assassination attempts on him, he refuses to demonize. He says, our white brothers made a mistake. There's this relentless humanizing because he was following Jesus. He was saying violence is never on. And I love it when he said, we will match your white hatred of us with our capacity to love you back. That's Jesus. And it's transformative. For me, it goes to the presence idea. Where is God? If he's up in heaven having a good time, what use is he? For me, I do believe that Jesus is the Son of God, whatever terms we want to apply in terms of content to that, God's presence has come in Jesus and seen and suffered the worst and shown still that you go on loving. That for me is why faith is so important.
Now, one final question that I've been known to ask more than one guest. What would a modern Western secular person find most surprising about Christianity were they to have a closer look?
I think they would find it surprising that Christianity, for its first 300 years, refused to be a chaplain to power. That it actually said, we will build the schools, hospitals, such as they were, not just for Christian poor, but for the Greco-Roman poor. We will love whoever. I think they would find it surprising that Christians refused to serve as soldiers. They were pacifists. They weren't going to kill anyone because God is love. They might find it surprising that the switch that happened when Christianity under Constantine became the official religion saw Christian pacifists become soldiers of the cross under the banner of Constantine and the cross. That radical love is really what turned the world upside down and is still needed today.
Well, Tim Costello, it's not over yet, but you've led a very rich and interesting life. You write about it beautifully in your book, A Lot with a Little. Certainly done a lot. I won't enter into whether it's been with a little or not, but it's been great having you in to talk about it. Thanks.
A delight. Thanks, Simon.
Tim Costello's memoir is out now. It's called A Lot with a Little. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And if so, please do leave us a rating or review and tell your friends about it who you think might appreciate it also. Next week on Life and Faith.
I am married to an Afa. I'm married to a Muslim man. I'm Christian. I speak the language. I follow the culture very as closely as I can. I would never dress, for example, in jeans or trousers. And I don't own any trousers, so yeah, I sure can't put them on. So that's bad luck. Am I Afa? No, I'm not. But what nationality am I? I don't really care. I don't believe in nationality. I really don't.